This program is brought to you with support from the U.S. EPA. We're here to present the EFC Network podcast. The Environmental Finance Center Network is a partnership of 12 centers serving 10 EPA regions. The EFCN provides training and technical assistance to small water and wastewater systems. This podcast series has been designed to help system personnel improve technical, managerial, and financial capacity of the utilities and communities they serve.
Welcome to the Small Wastewater System Technical Assistance Podcast from the Office of Water Programs at Sacramento State. This is Episode 6, Small Wastewater Systems Treatment Lagoons.
My name is Carissa, and I'm a communications coordinator here at the Office of Water Programs.
And my name is Samantha, and I'm an administrative support coordinator here at the Office of Water Programs. Today, we're talking about wastewater treatment lagoons, also called wastewater stabilization ponds. In this episode, we'll cover the biological and chemical processes that occur in wastewater treatment lagoons and ponds, the types of treatment lagoons, the challenges of operation, maintenance, and safety around lagoons.
So, Samantha, what exactly do wastewater treatment lagoons do?
Well, lagoons treat wastewater before discharging it back into the environment. These treatment systems play an important role in wastewater treatment and stabilization.
Good description. Treatment lagoons are a good option because they treat wastewater as effectively as a treatment plant, but with less costs. They also require less supervision.
Lagoons treat wastewater through a combination of physical, biological, and chemical processes. While most of this treatment occurs naturally, some systems add oxygen through aeration devices. Lagoons are classified as anaerobic, aerobic, and facultative, which is a little bit of both. We'll talk about these three types in a bit.
Let's go over a good treatment lagoon case study. In 2008, Pennsylvania's Pleasant Valley School District underwent an expansion. Two existing irrigation lagoons had been meeting the school's irrigation needs, but these two lagoons were getting overloaded and having problems with algae blooms and disinfection. The nutrient-heavy waters also needed proper treatment before irrigating athletic fields and other school grounds. To meet the goals for publicly occupied irrigating fields, the school district's lagoons needed more aeration. To address this need, the school district took the number of wastewater lagoons from 2 to 4 and added more aeration units. With this lagoon expansion, the school district could manage the water's nutrient levels, prevent stagnation, meet regulations, and most importantly, accomplish all of its irrigation goals.
I'd call that a success story. Today, we're dedicating this entire episode to treatment lagoons because they're so prevalent. Actually, the treatment lagoon is the most used process in the western states and in a lot of rural areas.
Including but not limited to Wyoming, Montana, Hawaii, the Dakotas, Georgia, Alabama, and Oklahoma.
In fact, it's likely that a lot of our audience members listening today work as operators at treatment lagoons.
Shout out to all the lagoon operators out there. Thank you for doing all of your great work. This one's for you.
Today, we'll go into the nitty-gritty about how treatment lagoons work. We'll talk about their advantages, and to be fair, we'll also talk about potential downsides and safety hazards.
Remember talking about constructed wetlands in episode 2 of our wastewater series?
That's right, the small North Carolina town that's effectively treating its wastewater and saving money with beautiful, functional, constructed wetland.
Exactly. Well, constructed wetlands are one form of treatment lagoon.
Okay, what are the major differences?
A treatment lagoon and a constructed wetland perform about the same function, but a constructed wetland is bigger and more park-like, while a lagoon is more like a pond. It's basically a big open space with water everywhere. A lagoon needs to be secured to keep the public away. People don't want to spend time at a lagoon, so it's the opposite of a park in that respect. A lagoon needs more space than a wastewater treatment facility, that is, it has a larger footprint. But compared to a constructed wetland, it has a smaller footprint.
Lagoons work relatively slowly to treat wastewater, so if you're planning a new system for a densely populated area and you need quick treatment turnaround, a wastewater treatment facility might better fit your needs.
Lagoons take more time to work out, but also require less supervision. In a treatment facility, at least one operator would be around all the time. But in a lagoon, an operator might need to visit only 3 times a week. I see what you mean about lagoon being lower maintenance. Anyway, let's get into it. How do treatment lagoons work?
Okay, as we mentioned earlier, there are three broad treatment lagoon types classified by their dissolved oxygen content. They're called aerobic, anaerobic, and facultative. In an aerobic lagoon, oxygen is almost always distributed throughout the entire depth. In an anaerobic lagoon, the oxygen requirements are much greater than the oxygen supply, so it's mostly devoid of oxygen. In a facultative lagoon, the upper layer is mostly aerobic, while the bottom layer is mostly anaerobic.
In aerobic lagoons, or the aerobic layer of a facultative lagoon, aerobic bacteria convert organic matter and wastewater to carbon dioxide and ammonia. These compounds, in turn, serve as nutrients for algae, microscopic plants with one or more cells, which are essential to lagoon operation.
Through photosynthesis, algae uses carbon dioxide in the water to produce free oxygen. The oxygen is then available to the aerobic bacteria that live in the lagoon.
On a typical summer day, 1 pound of algae in a healthy lagoon can produce 1.6 pounds of oxygen. At night, when there's no light for photosynthesis, algae use up the oxygen through respiration and produce carbon dioxide.
The alternating use and production of oxygen and carbon dioxide can cause variations daily and diurnally in the lagoon's pH and dissolved oxygen levels. Algae consumes carbon dioxide during the day, raising the pH. They produce carbon dioxide at night, lowering the pH.
Algae can be found in soil, water, and in the air. They grow naturally in lagoons without seeding and multiply rapidly in favorable conditions.
In anaerobic lagoons, or in the anaerobic layer of a facultative lagoon, a group of organisms known as acid producers first convert organic material to organic acids. At the same time, in an established lagoon, that's a well-developed lagoon that's been in use for some time, a group known as methane fermenters breaks down the organic acids from the acid producers to form methane gas, carbon dioxide, ammonia, water, and alkalinity.
In a successful facultative lagoon, aerobic processes take place in the surface layers, and anaerobic processes take place in the bottom layers.
Sometimes sludge decomposition in the anaerobic zone is interrupted, causing sludge to accumulate. If sludge accumulates and decomposition doesn't set in, it's most likely because of the appropriate bacteria being absent, a low pH, substances that slow or stop the process, or a low temperature.
Under these conditions, acid production will continue at a slower rate, but gas, or methane, production will slow significantly. Lagoon sludge storage is continuous, with small amounts stored during warm weather and larger amounts stored during cold weather.
Bacteria can't multiply quickly enough to handle waste at low temperatures. When the weather warms up, the acid producers begin to decompose the accumulated sludge deposits that build up over the winter.
If organic acid production is excessive, the pH drops, potentially disrupting the lagoon environment and generating hydrogen sulfide odors.
Hydrogen sulfide is not normally a problem in properly designed and operated lagoons. At high pHs, it dissociates or divides into hydrogen and hydrosulfide ions and may form insoluble metallic sulfides or sulfates. So lagoons with a pH above 8.5 don't emit odors even with large amounts of hydrogen sulfide. However, in northern climates during the spring, when the pH is low and the lagoon is just getting started, hydrogen sulfide odors can be an issue.
All organic matter that settles to the bottom of a stabilization lagoon from the various sludge decomposition processes is susceptible to methane fermentation, providing proper conditions. Once methane fermentation is established, it accounts for a significant portion of organic solids removal.
For methane fermentation to occur, lots of organic matter needs to be deposited and continually converted to organic acids. Also, the lagoon needs a large population of methane bacteria. These organisms require the right temperature, a sludge pH of 6.5 to 7.5, and alkalinity of several hundred milligrams per liter to buffer the organic acids.
The period when a lagoon is first put into operation is one of the most critical in its life. If at all possible, make sure the lagoon has at least a foot of water before introducing waste. Avoid odors from exposed waste solids by adding water to the lagoon ahead of time. So, when starting a lagoon, have a water source available.
Start the lagoon during the warmer months of the year. With a shallow starting depth, cold nights would let the lagoon contents cool too quickly. In general, the more efficient the treatment process is, the warmer the lagoon contents are.
After introducing waste into the lagoon, algal blooms typically appear in 7 to 12 days, but establishing a thriving biological community usually takes at least 60 days.
When your lagoon is a distinct green color, congratulations! A thriving algae population has established itself in your lagoon.
After 60 days have passed, bacterial decomposition of bottom solids is usually established. You can tell when bubbles rise to the surface near the lagoon inlet, near the majority of the sludge deposits. Even though the bottom is anaerobic, the gases' passage through the aerobic surface layers generally prevent odors.
During the first few weeks, discharge waste intermittently into the lagoon while constantly monitoring the pH. If possible, keep the lagoon's pH above 7.5. Because the acid-producing bacteria are digesting sludge, the bottom sludge's pH will initially be less than 7.
If the lagoon's pH begins to decline, divert discharge to another lagoon until the pH recovers. If you don't have another lagoon available, you can dilute the discharge with makeup water from another source until pH recovers. You need a high pH to promote the bottom sludge's balanced anaerobic fermentation.
High pH is also a good indicator of high algal activity. Because high algal metabolism removes carbon dioxide from the water, keeping the pH high. Persistently low pH indicates acid production. That causes odor. To raise a lagoon's pH, you can add soda ash or sodium carbonate to the influent.
Unfortunately, lagoons are probably neglected more than any other type of wastewater treatment process because they are relatively simple to operate. Many lagoon-related complaints are the result of neglect or poor housekeeping.
If lagoons are not monitored or operated correctly, then they'll smell. The odor tells on them that they're not being treated properly, and it also tells on the operator.
That's why it's so important to keep up with day-to-day operation and maintenance. It'll ensure peak treatment efficiency and present your plant to your neighbors as a well-run waste treatment facility.
Also, whoever's listening to this, please, make sure you properly secure your lagoon behind a reliable chain link fence or with other effective measures to keep the public out. The reason I'm saying this is that there have been accidents when lagoons have been accessible to the public at all, even if it's just through a hole in the fence.
Good point, Samantha. Let's avert a tragedy.
Scum accumulation is common in lagoons. It usually peaks in the spring when the water warms up and vigorous biological activity resumes. Wind normally breaks up scum accumulations and causes them to settle, but in the absence of wind or in sheltered areas, you'd need to use other methods.
If the scum's not broken up, it'll dry on top and crest over. Not only does the scum become more difficult to break up, but a species of blue-green algae, which can produce odors, is likely to become established on the scum.
If you allow scum to accumulate, it can grow to such proportions that it blocks a significant amount of sunlight from entering the lagoon. When this happens, algae's ability to produce oxygen decreases and odor issues may arise.
Scum rafts are unsightly. What's more, they can easily become a source of botulism, which can be fatal to any waterfowl or shore birds that may be drawn to the lagoon.
Scum is easily broken up if you deal with it quickly, and you can use many methods to break up scum, including agitating the scum from the shore with garden rakes, spraying jets of water from pumps or tank trucks, and using outboard motors on boats in large lagoons. Afterwards, air-cool the outboard motors to avoid clogging the cooling system with algae and scum.
Regardless of the process used, a wastewater treatment lagoon will most likely give off odors at some point. A word to the wise, when a lagoon develops odor issues, it's more likely to cause problems than other treatment lagoons.
Most odors are caused by overloading and poor housekeeping practices and can be eliminated with corrective measures. If a lagoon is overloaded, stop loading and divert influent to other available lagoons until the odor problem is resolved. Then, gradually resume loading the lagoon.
If there's an unexpected mechanical equipment shutdown, it may disrupt lagoon processes, resulting in odors. We strongly advise you to carefully create an emergency odor control plan.
In colder climates, the cold weather reduces biological activity, so odors usually appear during the spring warm-up. When the water in a lagoon warms, microorganisms become active and consume all the available dissolved oxygen, resulting in anaerobic conditions and odor production. Ways to reduce lagoon odors include recirculation from aerobic units, using floating aerators, and heavy chlorination.
Recirculating one part recycle flow to six parts influent flow from the aerobic lagoon to the inlet of an anaerobic lagoon will reduce or eliminate odors. If you use a recirculation system, two things to remember. One, the recirculation rate must not increase the flow rate through the lagoon to the point where the lagoon overflows. Two, to ensure the highest possible dissolved oxygen levels in the recirculated water, draw the recirculation water from the surface of the source lagoon.
Floating aeration and chlorination equipment is typically too expensive to leave idle while an odor problem develops. Instead, you can use small gasoline-powered pumps to recirculate lagoon contents and aid in recovery. These pumps have also been used to spray lagoon water on the lagoon surface in order to add more oxygen to the top layer of the lagoon and aid in recovery.
Odor masking chemicals are also promoted for this purpose, but our advice, don't wait until an emergency to plan for odor control. Materials or chemicals might take several days to arrive, so have alternate odor control methods ready to go.
Sodium nitrate, as opposed to sulfate compounds, is added to lagoons in some areas as an oxygen source for microorganisms. It prevents odor formation caused by sulfate's oxidization to sulfide. To be effective, the sodium nitrate needs even distribution throughout the lagoon's water. Many common organisms can use the oxygen and nitrate compounds in the absence of dissolved oxygen, so it acts quickly once mixed in the lagoon. The oxygen demand determines the amount of sodium nitrate you need.
Some operators have successfully dosed their treatment lagoons with sodium nitrate at concentrations ranging from 0.3 to 0.4 milligrams per liter. Liquid sodium hypochlorite or chlorine solution is a faster acting odor solution, but it's not always the best chemical because it interferes with biological waste stabilization.
If the lagoons have already frozen over in the winter and you expect them to develop odor problems when the ice thaws in the spring, when the water in the lagoon turns over, then you need a different odor control strategy. In this case, some operators apply sodium nitrate to the ice surface before it thaws so that the chemical is ready to supply oxygen when needed.
Weed control is an important part of good housekeeping. It's a simple task you can accomplish with manual removal methods, herbicides, and soil sterilants. Weeds around the edges of lagoons are particularly problematic because they provide a safe haven for mosquito breeding and scum accumulation. When the edges of lagoons are kept clear of weed growth, there is a little need for mosquito control. Weeds can also obstruct lagoon circulation.
Tools, for example, grow in depths shallower than 3 feet, so you'll need an operating lagoon level of at least 3 feet. Tools can appear singly or in clusters, but you'll need to remove them by hand as soon as possible. Otherwise, they'll multiply from the root system. Closely inspecting and immediately removing young plants daily is one of the best methods for controlling undesirable vegetation. Another two effective weed control strategies: use riprap or concrete on the lagoon banks. Keep 2 to 3 inches of gravel on the roads.
Suspended vegetation, like duckweed, won't typically thrive if the lagoon is subjected to a clean sweep of the wind. But shallow water encourages growth, so it'll almost certainly be a constant battle to keep emergent weeds from becoming well-established around lagoon banks. You can help control dike vegetation by mowing regularly and using a cover grass that crowds out undesirable growth.
Emergent weeds only grow when sunlight can reach the lagoon bottom. The single most effective way to prevent emergent growth is maintaining water at least 3 feet deep. More sunlight will reach the bottom of secondary or final lagoons because of their greater water clarity than will reach primary lagoons.
When you're pulling emergent or suspended weeds from the lagoon, wear protective gear like waterproof gloves, boots, and goggles to reduce your risk of infection from pathogens in the water. Also, to avoid odor and insect problems, bury the weeds.
Control measures take time and can be difficult, especially if there's a discharge into a receiving stream. Reduce the level in the lagoons, one at a time, if possible, before applying an insecticide. Holding the insecticide for at least 1 day kills more insects and lessens the insecticide's impact on receiving waters. Lowering the lagoons also causes weeds and insects to die. Apply insecticides on a calm, windless day and turn off any recirculation pumps.
But the most serious maintenance issue is probably levee slope erosion caused by waves or by surface runoff from precipitation. If it's allowed to continue, it'll narrow the levee crown, making access for maintenance equipment difficult. If the levee slope is made of easily erodible material, using bank protection material like stone, riprap, or broken concrete rubble can be a long-term solution.
Small pieces of broken street materials, curbs, gutters, bricks, and other suitable materials from building demolition are all good bank protection materials. You can also use riprap with a semi-porous plastic sheet. The sheet allows air and water to move in both directions, but prevents soils from moving. The sheet also discourages weed growth and crayfish digging. Geosynthetics are also an effective method of controlling levee erosion.
To prevent surface runoff erosion, plant portions of the lagoon levee or dike not exposed to wave action with low-growing spreading grass. Native grasses may seed the levees naturally, or you can consult local highway departments about suitable grasses to control erosion. If necessary, mow the grass to keep it from growing too tall.
Don't use large grazing animals, such as cows or horses, to control vegetation because they may damage levees near the waterline and complicate erosion problems. However, goats are an option because they've proven effective in controlling vegetation and grasses.
Don't allow plants or grasses with long roots, such as willows and alfalfa, to grow on levees because they can cause levee failure and costly repairs. Burrowing animals, such as muskrats, badgers, squirrels, and gophers, can also cause levee failure. Remove these animals from the levee as soon as possible and repair any burrowed holes. Local agricultural departments might be able to help you create a rodent control program.
Crown the tops of the levees so that rainwater drains over the side in a sheet flow. Otherwise, the water may flow a long way along the levee crown, accumulating enough flow to cause erosion when it finally spills over the side and down the slope. If the levees are to be used as roads during inclement weather, they should be paved or heavily graveled. If lagoon seepage or leakage appears on the outside of levees, contact your engineer or another qualified person to investigate and resolve the issue before further levee damage occurs.
Bar screens can remove the coarse material in a lagoon effluent. Check the screen at least once or twice a day and more frequently during storms. Clean the bar screen as often as needed. To avoid odors and flies breeding, dispose of the screenings daily in a sanitary manner, such as by burial. Another option is to put screenings in garbage cans and have your local garbage service dispose them at a sanitary landfill.
Many lagoon installations have grit removal chambers at the headworks to protect raw wastewater lift pumps or to keep influent lines from becoming clogged. Grit removal equipment comes in a variety of forms.
Grit removed by various types of mechanical equipment or by hand usually contains trace amounts of organic matter, so dispose of it in a sanitary manner. Burial is the most common disposal method. The permitting regulatory agency must approve screenings and grit disposal methods.
A high level of lagoon recirculation, ranging from 25% to 100%, can be extremely beneficial. As a result, the algae and other aerobic organisms are thoroughly mixed with the incoming raw wastewater. Simultaneously, you can achieve good oxygen transfer by passing the incoming water over a deck and down steps, or by using another type of aerator. However, this procedure may result in heat loss.
Engineers design and build lagoons based on qualified biological consultants' findings, current scientific knowledge, and lessons learned from previous successes and failures. These lagoons have successfully performed a variety of functions, providing they have knowledgeable, purposeful operators. As a whole, wastewater stabilization lagoons provide numerous benefits for smaller installations where land is inexpensive, and the location is remote from residential, commercial, and recreational areas.
So, in a nutshell, lagoons are a good choice where populations are small, land is plentiful, and construction costs are high. That's all for today, and we hope to see you back here soon.
Thank you for listening. For more information about wastewater treatment training and continuing education, visit our website at www.owp.csus.edu. We'll also post a transcript of this episode and links to other episodes on small wastewater system operation.
Have a great day.
Thank you to all our listeners for tuning into this episode of the EFC Network Podcast, brought to you with support from the US EPA. Be sure to stay tuned for future EFC Network podcast episodes.